Good afternoon from listener-supported community radio, KKRN 88.5 FM. This is Wake Up Call, and I'm your host, Doug Craig, and our engineer is Randy Compton. Say hello, Randy.
Good afternoon.
Glad to have you with us. And Wake Up Call is an effort to create a space through which the truth can shine. Our planet is undergoing unprecedented and massive transformation while most of us are unaware of what this means. It's time to wake up to the climate crisis and accept our role as healers of the earth. I'm really excited today to welcome our guest, Edward Davey, the author of Given Half a Chance, 10 Ways to Save the World. Welcome, Edward. Glad to have you.
Doug, thank you so much for having me. I'm so grateful.
Yes. Edward Davey is the director of the Geographic Deep Dives of the Food and Land Use Coalition, a global initiative to transform the world's food and land use symptoms, and this is co-led by the World Resources Institute. Edward is responsible for the day-to-day management of the coalition's in-depth country work in Colombia, Ethiopia, Indonesia, China, India, and Australia, working in partnership with World Resources Institute colleagues and other local partners. He is also a contributor to the coalition's forthcoming global report, as well as to the food and land use chapter of the New Climate Economy's flagship 2018 report. Edwards had a rich and extensive history of environmental work. He was the senior program manager at the Prince of Wales International Sustainability Unit, where he co-led a number of international initiatives on RED, which we can talk about later, R-E-D-D plus, zero deforestation, commodity supply chains, forest landscape restoration, and climate change. Prior to that work, he served as lead advisor on environment in the Colombian Presidency's International Cooperation Office in Bogota. He began his career as a researcher at Oxfam and for the UN Human Development Report. He also spent a number of years working for a humanitarian organization working in the Middle East, quite a bit, and that probably barely scratches the surface. Edward has a master's with distinction in environment and development from the London School of Economics and Political Science, and an undergraduate degree in modern languages from the University of Oxford. So without further ado, again, welcome. And so let's just talk about the book to start off. In your book, you describe 10 paths by which we can safeguard and protect this precious planet into which our children, including your son, Ollie, has been born. So my question is, why write this book and why is it so important right now?
Thank you, Doug. Well, it really was Ollie's imminent arrival in the world that prompted me to write the book. I've been working on the environment now for some years, as you kindly mentioned. But there's nothing like having your own child coming into the world to make you think, my goodness, how is this century and the centuries to come going to play out? And so in the 9 months prior to his arrival and the 9 months that followed, I really took the chance to scribble down as best as I could my vision of how we could still turn things round. It wasn't an easy task. Like everyone working in this field, I have my moments of pessimism and despair, frankly, but I genuinely believe that we can put the world on a better course, and furthermore that we have to try to do our best. It's ethically the right thing to do. You know, humanity at its best is immensely creative and moral, and I feel if we harness the best of the human spirit in the decades to come, we can still turn this around, but we don't have much time. And so the spirit of the book really is, you know, let's do everything we can in our power to put the world on a more sustainable course.
And in your book, you talk about these 10 paths, which I'll run through quickly here. The first one is renewables, and then we have forests, soil, water, biodiversity, the ocean, cities, waste, people, and you finish with action, and you give us quite a few action items. And then there's an epilogue that talks about hope, which we all have to have. We're not going to obviously cover all that in this hour. We're going to do our best, though. One of the things I learned, which was really startling and appalling, is I didn't realize that it wasn't just our country that subsidizes the fossil fuel companies. It's the whole world, to the tune of $5.3 trillion a year. I just can't imagine what we could do with that money if we weren't just giving it away to the fossil fuel lobby, to these oil and gas companies. My question is, how can we convince the world's governments to stop subsidizing dirty fuel and instead support and encourage renewables moving forward?
It's a very good question. And there's also $700 billion we spend on agricultural subsidies every year. And I think for all of these subsidies, the challenge before us is to tell a convincing economic story about how these subsidies could be better deployed. It's a kind of just transition for societies. These subsidies often aren't beneficial to the poorest in society. They have a sort of weighting towards the middle and the upper echelons of those societies. And actually, if you redeployed subsidies, it could be hugely beneficial in terms of economic growth, the reduction of inequality. And so there's a story in the US, there's a story in the UK about workers who are currently in, you know, the coal industry, for example, moving to renewables, or farmers who are currently engaged without wishing to in unsustainable practices, going on a journey towards more sustainable ones. But I think we just have to be very clear that this is a socially just and desirable transition. But of course, the political economy of such a transition is challenging, and the incumbents have huge power and weight. And in the book, I describe how some of the fossil fuel companies hold huge sway in our society. You know, they fund cultural events that we all value and so on. So this isn't easy by any stretch, but I think we can do it if we tell a good story about what those kinds of reforms would entail.
In your book, you describe the Paris Agreement as the single most important international security challenge of the century to come. Why is that?
If we fail to address climate change, the likely impacts of this volatile and changing climate are massive in terms of human security. I mean, here in Europe, in the UK, we already face this prospect of many hundreds, thousands of very impoverished Africans crossing the Mediterranean, risking their lives to come to Europe. And already this is driving a populist revolt, basically, across Europe, and a very strong, aggressive response in Italy, Hungary, and elsewhere. These are very small, minuscule numbers by comparison with the predicted numbers of climate migrants, quote-unquote, that are anticipated to follow if we don't curtail climate change. Also, if you look at India and China, there are several billion people who depend for their fresh water supply on the continuing health of the ecosystem of the Himalayan mountains. And if climate change continues apace, you could imagine a situation where there is water scarcity. In fact, we know there's already water scarcity in a significant number of the world's countries. A recent research from WRI points to that. So I think that's the essence of the story. You know, address climate change, and there are so many benefits. Fail to address it, and it's a huge security challenge for our time, as well as a challenge on many other fronts.
And as you've written in your book, renewable energy isn't just good for the planet, it's really good for humanity. It's clear we can all see it. We're kind of on the verge of an economic boon, but we just have to really fully commit to what you described as zero net carbon growth or climate neutrality, and accept that renewables are the energy of the future, and that future really is now. You also quote Rachel Kite, who says the future of the world's energy system is decentralized, digitalized, decarbonized, and democratized. Can you talk about how, the potential of what we're looking at if we're smart enough to seize it.
I mean, it's clear to me that if we really put our minds to it, we could, by 2050, be living a zero carbon life or world or energy system. I mean, it will take one hell of a transition, but, you know, think of the moon landings and think of those fossil fuel subsidies you mentioned. I mean, if we put, you know, a good solid amount of that towards research, innovation, like Bill Gates is doing, others, Elon Musk, surely we can bring forward those renewable systems that we're already seeing deployed in real time. I mean, think of solar, think of wind, think of geothermal in some instances. I'm agnostic on nuclear power. I worry about the waste, but I'm sure it will play a part. We can pivot to a much better system. And that question of decentralized, democratized energy is vital. I mean, a lot of sub-Saharan Africa, for example, could completely leapfrog the fossil fuel intensive energy system that other countries have relied on and move straight to a decentralized system that gives power to local communities and so on. But to do that, you need huge investment and commitment. And in a sense, you need a Marshall Plan, in a sense, to take us from where we are today to where we need to be. And I'm very inspired by the Marshall Plan because after the ravages of the Second World War, your country got behind a very visionary commitment to help Europe come back from this terrible tragedy that we'd been through. And we did. And it was far-sighted and it was visionary. And I feel we need the same for this international environmental predicament that we're in. But again, the spirit is, you know, this is possible. We know what we need to do.
If you're just tuning in, this is Wake Up Call on KKRN 88.5 FM. And we are at kkrn.org on the internet. We are a listener-supported radio. I'm Doug Craig, and our guest today is Edward Davey. He's the director of the Geographic Deep Dives of the Food and Land Use Coalition, a global initiative to transform the world's food and land use systems. And he's written a book called Given Half a Chance, 10 Ways to Save the World. I highly recommend it. In your book, you indicate, you know, there's so many startling facts in your book that kind of surprised me, and this is another one. You indicated that one way or another, the world will be investing $90 trillion in the next couple decades in infrastructure. And you put it simply that the only question is whether it will be high or low carbon. Can you explain that?
It would be very easy to continue to invest in ports, roads, coal power stations. If you look at the China Belt and Road Initiative, there's a lot of that happening. And of course, in some countries, there's a need for that. But equally, we could think imaginatively about the infrastructure we need. You know, should those roads not be climate resilient to this changing climate that we foresee? Are there ways of circumventing the construction of roads through the world's remaining protected areas, whether they're in the US or in sub-Saharan Africa or here in Europe or whatever? Could we not invest instead of coal in the renewables that we were discussing a moment ago? There is a huge need. Investment in infrastructure is necessary. It could drive growth. But we'll need to think about ensuring that that investment is resilient in this changing climate and also that it's low carbon. And again, that's a vindication of this push on innovation that many countries committed to in Paris and that many investors like Bill Gates are getting behind. Let's think differently over the next 100 years about what kind of infrastructure we need. A lot of this will play out, of course, in the world's cities, where 70% of the population will live by 2030. There are much better ways of building cities now, compact, better public transport, fewer cars. Let's think creatively about the infrastructure in the urban environment as well.
And meanwhile, the Amazon rainforest is currently on fire, after apparently being deliberately set aflame by farmers inspired by Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro. He seems to have some naked contempt for the environment. You write in your book how the future of the world hangs on how Brazil treats its rainforest. What are your thoughts about this critical moment in our history?
It's desperately worrying. Bolsonaro has adopted a very aggressive tone on the Amazon. There's always fire in the Amazon, and farmers in the Cerrado region use fire as part of their way of regenerating the soil and so on. But the extent of the fires seems to be very acute. It's as much as was lost in the early 2000s, which was the previous highest set of numbers. But the broader concern, I think, in the Brazilian Amazon is that Bolsonaro seems to be wanting to renege on Brazil's historic leadership on protected areas and giving land to indigenous peoples who have lived in those forests for millennia. There's a strong current in Brazilian society around this is our land, this is our forest, don't intervene. And indeed, that's played out in the last couple of days. My hope and prayer is that the Brazilian people themselves, many of whom, majority of whom love the forest, are proud of it, will get behind a kind of national response to this. You know, we must protect the forest. I mean, Brazil itself stands to suffer hugely if it loses the Amazon in terms of the agricultural production in the south of the country, in terms of international markets that are increasingly concerned by deforestation. So I hope that the situation will be turned around, but it's certainly been a very worrying time, and one's heart just bleeds seeing these terrible photos of forest fires across Brazil at the moment.
We're broadcasting from downtown Redding, California, where a little over a year ago we had the car fire that swept through our community and burned up over 1,000 homes. And just 70 miles from here approximately is Chico in Paradise, where the campfire killed over 80 people and burned up the entire community of Paradise. So, you know, we're familiar with fire and its destructive capacity, and yet we can't give in to this, right? So we need to follow the lead of Costa Rica and Kenya and Canada and Ethiopia, these countries that are, responding to deforesting with reforesting. And can you talk about how important it is now that we not just sit back and watch our forests burn up, that we really have to get engaged and kind of change our relationship with the wilderness and forested areas?
Yes, and those fires in California were very upsetting. I remember them well. Of course, we need to stop cutting down the world's forests, particularly some of these vital tropical forests in the Amazon and the Congo Basin and in Papua and West Papua in Indonesia. But also, we can restore the world. We can plant many more trees. I mean, look, in Ethiopia about a month ago, the prime minister oversaw, in the course of a single day, the planting of 350 million trees. And I think a month previously in India, there had been 223 million planted in a day. Now, of course, it's not just a question of planting them. You've got to look after them, and you've got to make sure that they flourish. But the world could and should undergo a massive afforestation campaign, effectively, but it has to be the right trees in the right places. It can't just be eucalyptus around the world or poplars and so on. But, you know, there is a huge amount to be done, and it's a very good thing to do. I mean, look at flood prevention. Here in the UK, some of our landscapes are so denuded that when floods have happened in the last 5 years, everyone's felt, gosh, if we'd had a few more trees in that landscape, on those slopes, the flood would have been much reduced in its impact. And so I think really thinking about restoration, and I think the title of the book, Given Half a Chance, was a phrase that I had unwittingly been using in the book that my editor alighted on, and it's, given half a chance, nature restores itself. If you let a very debilitated area recover, it's amazing how quickly that happens. Imagine if we really put our minds to it, that the earth itself is very resilient. Let's give it a chance.
And I noticed in your book, as I was reading, that it all just seemed to all be connected, which we all know. But you kind of lay out how it's all connected, how forests are connected to soil, and soil's connected to groundwater, and all of it's connected to people and the oceans and the atmosphere and how what we do to one part affects other parts. And, you know, when we talk about soil, you know, it's kind of critical. And there was one startling statistic here that each year we lose 24 billion tons of fertile soil because of our unsustainable farming methods. So, you know, going forward, it isn't just about planting trees or driving electric cars. We have to look at everything, and including, you know, the kind of the insane way we've farmed for the last century or so.
Absolutely. And there's so much to be done in terms of more productive agriculture, but more regenerative practices. And I think California is a lot of very good examples of this happening. You know, we need to completely transform the way we care for the land and reduce fertilizers and pesticides in many instances. This also comes up to the important question of how much meat the world should consume. And in the report from the Food and Land Use Coalition that's coming out in a month or so, we will be making the argument that in many parts of the world, many consumers will have to eat less meat, certainly red meat, and make sure that that meat is cultivated in the right conditions, both in terms of animal welfare, but also on the right soils, the right landscapes. But the bottom line, I think, is many parts of the world will have to eat much less meat, really, and use those soils and those lands for other crops that we need, and also for the restoration and recovery of the natural world and the planting of trees that we were discussing a moment ago. But the bottom line is we need to channel our inner Wendell Berry, one of the great luminaries from the US, who's written so poignantly about soil over the last 60 years.
I'm going to quote you now from your book. You write, "Today, as a result of fertilizer use and runoff, soil erosion, creeping desertification, and tropical forests being cleared, global agriculture and land use contributes more emissions to the atmosphere than all of the world's industry or transport, approximately one-third of the world's total greenhouse gas emissions." That is a startling set of facts you lay out there. Can you talk about that, please?
It is striking, and it's true, and it's been vindicated again by the most recent report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change on land. Climate and Land, published in August. We tend to overlook the role of the land in climate. Our mental image of what's driving climate change is cars and smokestacks and industry and transport, aviation, and so on. And all of that is true. But actually, there is this huge chunk of the global climate challenge that's attributable to the land. And that's why it's so important to pursue a whole set of practices that are very well laid out in a WRI report published recently called Creating a Sustainable Food Future. Really, it's at least 20 things that need to be done. I mean, from one example is to reduce the world's food loss and waste. I mean, we lose and waste in the order of a third of the food that we produce around the world. And that seems, you know, ethically abominable in and of its own right, given that there are 820 million people who go to bed hungry every night in the world. But in addition to that, it's obviously a terrible climate impact because all that food required inputs. It required soil, fertilizer, and so on. And then it was lost, either in the field or in our refrigerators around the world. So that's one thing one can do. Obviously, protecting the world's forests and peatlands is hugely important. Restoring degraded land, better agricultural practices, and then also this shift in diets that I was describing earlier. But the land is complex, and farmers need to feel that they own this transition that I'm describing. I think it's not going to work if the world scientists simply say, this is what needs to happen. I think farmers need to lead by example, and farmers learn from one another, and they are very quick on the uptake. And so I think the examples around the world of where farms are pursuing regenerative practices, I hope that there's going to be a huge and fast uptake of those practices among those who manage the land around the world.
And on this issue of eating less meat, again, we see the connection to to all these other topics that we're talking about. For example, you know, just one hamburger that we might eat requires 660 gallons of water. A pound of beef requires 1,800 gallons. Sweden and Norway are pushing for a healthier vegetable-based diet in their nations. It's kind of leading the way for the rest of the world to follow. And then when we think about, again, what's going on right now in Brazil with the burning rainforests, a lot of that is to clear the land for cattle and growing food for cattle. So we really do have to reevaluate, you know, how we've approached this issue. And I remember back in the 70s, there was an author that wrote A Diet for a Small Planet, and she was advocating at that time for, you know, a vegetarian future. So truly, that's an important factor going forward, is how to see how that's all connected.
Absolutely. And it's not a question of the whole world going vegan, although I'm not a vegan myself, but I'm interested in the thought experiment. What would happen if that did happen? I think it would be very strikingly positive. But at least many millions, billions of the world's population substantially reducing their meat consumption now. There are parts of the world, including Ethiopia, where I work, where arguably many Ethiopians need to eat more meat. They have a micronutrient deficit in their diets at present, and that would best be alleviated through more consumption of red meat, but also chicken and so on. So this is definitively a context-specific story. But I think the core line is clear. Then there's the question of fish and making sure that we fish more sustainably. So many of the world's fisheries are also overfished at present. So there's now a pivot happening towards aquaculture. But you've got to be careful about aquaculture too, because at present, many of those farms, salmon farms and so on, are not sustainable themselves. And you're feeding big fish with small fish and so on. So the net impact on the sea is still intense. So we need to navigate all of this with great care. But the bottom line is, you know, mainly the diet should be vegetables, nuts, and so on. Nuts, of course, have an impact of their own. And a little bit of meat, really well prepared and grown in the right conditions and so on. And that's also very good for our health, by the way. So there are benefits over and beyond climate and animal welfare.
You're listening to Wake Up Call on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm Doug Craig, the host of Wake Up Call, and we're listening and speaking with Edward Davey. He's the author of an excellent book called Given Half a Chance, 10 Ways to Save the World. We're going to take a break in a moment here. We're supported by listeners like you, and we're brought to you by volunteers from our community. If you're ready to support local community radio, we ask you to go to our website, kkrn.org, and click on the donate button, or you can also mail a check to P.O. Box 188, Montgomery Creek, California, 96065. And you can also call 530-337-1101 to volunteer at KKRN. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes and airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Churn world serves its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Feed it up an ox. Speak grunt. No strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Bite down. High wire and a fire. Representing seven games in a government for hire and a combat site. Left to us are coming in a hurry with the furies breathing down your neck. Team, my team reporters. Trump, Kevin Kraft, look at that, no plane, fine, then, uh-oh, uh-oh.
Good afternoon. This is Doug Craig, host of Wake Up Call on KKRN 88.5 FM. We're speaking with Edward Davey. He's the author of Given Half a Chance, 10 Ways to Save the World. And we're talking about the different paths by which we can reclaim the planet and restore it for our children and future generations. There are a number of topics that Edward touches on in the book. We won't get to all of them. He touches on renewables, the forest, soil, water, biodiversity, the oceans, cities, waste, people, and specific actions we can take. Let's talk about water. We've touched on it a little bit. There are a number of things going on in the world related to the water issue. I know Cape Town recently ran out of water or came close to doing that. I know that India, the parts of India that's fed by glacial melt, is looking at a water crisis. We still have nearly a billion people that don't have access to safe drinking water. Over 2 billion people lack access to basic sanitation. China is doing some major infrastructure building around the planet related to something called the Belt and Road Initiative, One Belt, One Road. And then all the dams that are being built, that have been built and continue to be built. Give us a sense of what we need to do in relation to water to preserve a habitable planet for the future.
We need to manage it with so much more care, and in some places that will probably mean pricing it properly. At present, in many countries, the true cost of water is just not accounted for in the way economies are structured and so on. In the book, I describe quite a lot of the benefits of what might be referred to as traditional water management approaches, in Rajasthan, in the cities of the Middle East, in the marshlands of southern Iraq. And I'm not trying to idealize these approaches and argue that they're necessarily applicable across the whole world today. But it's true that in the past, in human societies, often we worked out ingenious ways of managing water with great care, whereas today much of the way we manage water could be characterized as profligate and short-termist, effectively. So I think we just need to be much more careful about how we manage the world's finite fresh water. And there are examples where countries and communities and companies have turned a situation around. And even in the marshlands of southern Iraq, which was an ecosystem I got to know in a past job, terribly decimated by Saddam Hussein in his barbaric attempt to suppress the Marsh Arabs in the 90s and the early 2000s. It's not recovered its original state, but since 2003, there's been a concerted effort to try to restore those ecosystems. And through, again, more traditional approaches to the management of that ecosystem, much of the fresh water has come back. So I think we just need to proceed with great care. And a lot of it's also to do with data and making sure we really understand the state of the world's water, particularly in fast diminishing water tables beneath some of the world's biggest cities.
In your chapter on biodiversity, you help us understand why that is incredibly important, that, we are all connected, from insects and the krill in the ocean, all up through the life cycle of animals and species. We're all connected, and many of us have heard that we're in the sixth great extinction, and we know that the current extinction rate is approximately 100 extinctions per million species, or 1,000 times higher than the natural background rate, which is kind of mind-boggling to consider. You mentioned a study that predicts that we could lose half of Africa's bird and mammal species in this century. There are some seed banks that are that have been developed and hold nearly a million samples of seeds. So there are some things being done, and And you talked about Ethiopia having some of the original varieties of crops, and we need to be aware of that. And you also refer to the incredible amount of rangers around the world that get murdered because people want to, you know, it's the poaching crisis. They want to just go in and kill off animals and for their own use. Can you give us a kind of an understanding of what we need to do moving forward with this huge challenge of preserving biodiversity?
It is such a huge challenge, and there's a very important meeting coming up in 2020 hosted by the government of China in Kunming in October 2020, where new biodiversity targets will be established. And it's terrific that the Chinese are hosting this, and there will be a lot of interest in how ambitious this meeting is. I mean, much of the world's biodiversity is found in a whole series of extraordinary places. And, of course, many of those are linked to tropical forests. And the biomes we've been discussing, including the Amazon, the Congo Basin, the Mekong Basin, the forests of Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, and so on. But there's also, of course, tremendous marine biodiversity. So a lot of this is to do with really protecting the areas where biodiversity flourishes, working with local communities so that they benefit from this protection. This is not a question of excluding people from their ancestral lands, but it is a question of really enforcing better management practices, protecting the protectors, as you mentioned, also giving rights to indigenous people. You know, a lot of the world's environmental defenders are indigenous peoples who are very brave, who are under great threat, and they are also the custodians of biodiversity around the world. So a lot of this is about rights for indigenous people, local people, better protected areas, and so on. There's also, of course, a huge role for science and research. We do have these extraordinary seed banks, including a number here in the UK linked to Kew Gardens, but there are seed banks in India and Mexico and around the world, Ethiopia, as you mentioned. So we need to be protecting the places where these species exist and funding much more research. There's so much we don't know about the world's biodiversity. And we also need to be addressing climate change, because climate change itself poses a huge threat to the survival of the world's species. A lot of it's also about better planning. You know, many countries are home to extraordinary riches, but they often behave as if they're not, or not aware of it. And so senior decision makers in countries need to take biodiversity on board. And also the economics of biodiversity. And here in the UK, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Finance Minister, has commissioned a review on the economics of biodiversity, which will come out next year and hopefully provide finance ministers with additional arguments in favor of protecting biodiversity.
We're speaking with Edward Davey. He's the author of 10, or Given Half a Chance, 10 Ways to Save the World. And in your book, you talk about the oceans where we have treated it very poorly, like other ecosystems around the world, with overfishing and, of course, the plastic pollution is well known. We find that as the planet warms, that the ocean is becoming warmer too, and also becoming more acidic. We find that about half of the world's population, some 3 billion people, depend on fish as their primary source of protein. And even if we were to stop all global emissions today, it would take around 75 years before the effects of acidification were to fully reverse. What can we do? I mean, there are some exciting things happening with the ocean. What are we doing, and what must we do in the future to restore ocean health?
The ocean has suffered from a chronic absence of governance, in a sense. You know, there are X number of conventions which pertain to the ocean, but none has yet been able to deliver better and more sustainable management for the ocean. And colleagues in WRI and elsewhere are working to try to broker a new global settlement on the ocean in the coming years, which governments will have to sign up to and abide by. So part of this is about better policing and enforcement. For example, with unsustainable fisheries, you know, you can, through the Port States Measurements Act, you can basically ensure that in every port where fishery, unsustainable fish are being landed, those ports tighten their practices and don't allow manifest overfishing to be overfished catch to be brought in. So part of it's governance, institutions. Again, the whole marine protected areas agenda is important. Often these are paper parks in a sense, you know, areas that are designated as protected, but in actual fact are being overfished. So addressing climate change is also important because, of course, the acidification that's happening is driven by climate change and the broader tendencies in climate that we've already discussed. But basically, it's a combination of governance, investment in protection, and better management. And reform of fossil fuel subsidies also important because much of the overfishing that's currently taking place is being done as a result of access to cheap fuel, which is underwritten by subsidies. And if those were reformed, that would also take the pressure off. But again, a bit like with agriculture, there needs to be a plan in place to ensure a just transition for fisher folk around the world. They can't lose out. That would be political dynamite and also unfair. Then the benefits of a transition to more sustainable management are significant, but there is a short-term loss for some fisher folk, and they need to be supported in that journey, just as the same applies for coal workers or beef farmers.
We're talking with Edward Davey. He is the author of Given Half a Chance, 10 Ways to Save the World. And this is Wake Up Call. I'm Doug Craig on KKRN. 88.5 FM or KKRN.org. In your book, Edward, you lay out 10 paths by which we can save the planet. We've covered, I think, the first six. I'm going to skip over cities and waste, but I do encourage our listeners to purchase the book, put it on their Kindle, or buy the book and read it. It's really excellent. He lays out an excellent way of thinking about some very serious problems that we all face. In your book, you talk about the ninth path, which is people, and you lay out three areas of concern there. One is population growth. Another is our relationship with food. And finally, especially in a country like America, you know, how we are consumers and how our need to consume and purchase material items is also damaging the planet and damaging the future that our children and future generations will grow up in. So can you help us understand what people need to do about people going forward?
Well, I tried to be quite nuanced in this chapter because obviously the population issue is massive. We are 7.6 billion today, and we are projected to be 9.7 billion, I think, in 2050, depending on which projections you follow. And clearly, each of us has an environmental impact. But what I also wanted to convey was that some of us have more of an impact than others. And, you know, it may very reasonably be said that my footprint, my personal footprint, is greater than a family of four in countries that I know and love in sub-Saharan Africa. And I wanted to try to capture that point because it's also a question of how we all live, and consumption is a huge issue. You know, many of us are huge consumers, and all of the consumption that we bring in our daily lives has an environmental impact, whether it's the clothes we buy or the consumer goods that we buy and so on. And then there's the issue of diet that we've discussed in the course of this conversation, which is also significant because, again, you know, beef consumption around the world varies hugely according to countries. So the combination of these three things is important to get right. But, of course, on the population issue, you know, every country, every woman in the world should have access to reproductive health care and rights, and that's important in and of its own right. But it would also hasten the demographic transition. But then we need to take care with our diet, and we need to tread more lightly on the face of the planet. And those three things together, I think, might see us through.
And in your book, you make a connection that I've heard before, but is not naturally intuitive. you make the connection between educating girls and women across the planet, that as the education of our female humans increases, our carbon emissions decrease. That doesn't seem intuitive, really, but there is a strong connection between those two things, correct?
That's right. And there was a rather wonderful project led by colleagues in the US called Project Drawdown, which actually argued that, you know, girls' education would be the single biggest contribution you could make to the mitigation of climate change globally. Basically, girls who go to school for longer are less likely to have as many children as girls who are either forced to leave, or yes, society expects them to leave school as young as 12, 14. And so it's a combination of girls' education, equity between girls and boys in schools around the world, but then also teaching boys and girls about contraceptive use, about reproductive health care, but giving girls the power over their own bodies, which in so many countries of the world is not a given, is fundamentally the right thing to do. It's entirely justified on its own terms, but it happens that it would also bring about a hastening of the demographic transition, which is a process that's happening anyway in most countries of the world. But with aggressive investment in education and reproductive health care, information rights, and so on, that transition happens more quickly.
In your final path, your 10th path is action, and maybe we could spend the next little while on the show as we get toward the end of the program talking about some of those specific actions. You know, the first two that you mentioned are economics and politics. You know, what can we do in those two areas to, you know, really make a difference in saving the planet for future generations?
I think on economics, we've just got to be very clear and bullish in showing that action on climate change and the environment is good for economic growth. And it is. And there's a lot of evidence behind that, including the evidence that the Global Commission on Economy and Climate has assembled over the last 6 years. But we also need to argue that if we don't act on climate and the environment, there is no economy in the future. And it's amazing how many economists of the present day don't seem to understand that or expect it, or at least it's not top of the list in most economic discussions or papers being published and so on. And economics is hugely important in politics, and so we've just got to be brilliant at describing how there's a better future out there which addresses the political currents of our times, the great dissatisfaction and justifiable anger that many people feel about globalization and inequality. And there's a sort of story here about justice and about a moral future, a better future that's underpinned by good economics grounded in the environment and action on climate change, but also good politics. And I think on the politics, one of the arguments I make in the book is, you know, let's not be divided by action on the environment. I mean, in the US, many of the great environmental legislators, many of the most extraordinary protected areas you have, were bequeathed to the nation by Republicans. And I think the politicization of action on climate and the environment has been deeply regrettable in the last 20, 30 years. And it's something we've got to overcome, because this whole set of issues described in the book belongs to us all across the political spectrum. And we were discussing Brazil earlier, and I would love to find a way for Bolsonaro and his current of feeling in Brazil, which is obviously very acute, and for President Trump and those who support him, to feel the same sense of acute concern and desire to act on the environment that others of different political persuasions feel. And I feel that that's our biggest challenge, in a sense.
In that final path, the action path, besides economics and politics, you touch on the law, business, faith, media and social networks, technology and innovation, a very interesting area of empathy and education, and you describe a new narrative. We don't have a whole lot of time. I think we have about 5 minutes left. So just would like to give you a chance to touch on some of those actions in any of those areas that you think are vital going forward that we should know about right now.
I think the law is powerful, and there is some extraordinary environmental work being done using the power of the law. Media is obviously incredibly important. Social media, you know, we are more knowledgeable and more connected than perhaps we've ever been, and we need to find ways of using that to the benefit of this cause rather than to its detriment. The faith story for me is incredibly important. I mean, there are billions of the world's people who are moved by faith, and of course, all of the faith traditions have a strong sense in their literature of custodianship and care and so on. And you know, some of the traditions have other stories which perhaps just distinct from that. But, you know, all of them share ultimately this sense of, you know, this huge responsibility we have for this one planet that we share. And so I think mobilizing the faith community is important. And in the Catholic tradition, Pope Francis has done that. And similar things are happening in the other faiths. Then in the last bit of that chapter, I talk about a new story, a new narrative. And I do think this is very important. We live in a really febrile time. Stories and narratives take power. They take flight so quickly. Many of them are profoundly inimical to this agenda about environmental concerns. So those of us who are trying to argue for action on the environment and climate and a better, more dignified future for the world's people need to find some new story about what it is we're driving at. And it's got to be a story that speaks to those who feel aggressively against environmental action. And I don't know if it's about pride or about concern, love of one's land. I mean, I think there's just going to be, we're going to have to cut through. And of course, then that comes to the issue of education. And young people have a huge role to play here. And I've been very inspired by Greta, who's sailing across the Atlantic as we speak, to the UN Climate Summit. You know, the young people around the world are deeply concerned, and that's a wonderful thing to see, but they're not in power yet. And so those of us who are in power or near power need to act fast to put the planet on a better course until the young people are elected into office in the next 10 years, we hope. So that those are some of the issues that are discussed in the last chapter.
In your book, you have an epilogue titled Hope, and it makes me think, too, of how you started the book in terms of referencing your son Oliver or Ollie. And I have two daughters, and I know years ago James Hansen, the famous climate scientist, talked about his grandchildren in a book. So as we wrap up the show, we have a couple minutes left, just let's go out on a hopeful note that we do love our children, and if we have grandchildren, we love them. We want for them all that we've had and enjoyed, and we want that for future generations. So what gives you hope, and what can we all be hopeful about as we struggle together to fight this?
I'm very hopeful about the best of the human spirit. I really do. I mean, look at Martin Luther King, look at Gandhi, look at the abolition of slavery, look at global environmental action that has been successful on the ozone layer and so on. At our best, you know, we can turn this around. It's not a good time in the world at the moment. The politics are challenging, to say the least. But I'm very hopeful that there is such a level of concern, and also people's innate sense of what is right and their love for the natural world could mean that we're on the crest of a massive wave of action and concern. And Bill McKibben in his latest book describes that. You know, we are a globally connected community of people who are trying to turn this around. And we've also got wonderful young leaders who are showing us a new path, including Greta Thunberg, who is a powerful voice. So I'm very inspired that we can and must and will change the world in the next 10 to 12 years. But it's all hands on deck. There's not a moment to lose. And we need massive action, political action in every country, in every state. And so I think that's the message. But the love of our children, of course, inspires us. I spent today on Hampstead Heath in London with Ollie, whom you kindly mentioned, and my wife, and we're expecting our second. And, you know, the love one feels for one's own children is a powerful motivating force, because this is their world that they're coming into, and we owe it to them and to everybody to try to turn this around, and we will.
We've been speaking with Edward Davey. He's the author of Given Half a Chance, 10 Ways to Save the World. And I encourage everyone to purchase this book and read it, and then put it into action. Join with others in your community to make a difference for our children and future generations. Thank you. Thank you very much, Edward.
Thank you, Doug. I've so enjoyed it. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Yep, glad to have you. You've been listening to community-supported KKRN 88.5 FM. We're supported by listeners like you and brought to you by volunteers from the community. If you're ready to support KKRN, all you have to do is go to the website, kkrn.org, click on the donate button, or you can mail a check to P.O. Box 188, Montgomery Creek, California, 96065. Thank you again. This is Doug Craig on Wake Up Call, and we'll talk to you later. Tom Hartman is coming up next.